Mr. Reynolds mentioned how the country's falling away from God and not believing anymore, and it strikes me, and I always wonder, what are you going to stand on when the bottom falls out, and how are people going to go forward? And I guess the answer is they're not very well going to do that. How do you do it without God? And people don't believe anymore, and they don't believe in the Bible. And when I was younger, it was the platform that we argued from, and the person you were arguing with would say, you know, you're interpreting that a little bit wrong. But now they say, don't bring that book up. It has no meaning whatsoever to me. And you wonder, where are we going? How fast are we going down? And of course, I guess we knew this would happen, but I wanted to ask the question today. It struck me that we were talking in part about the same thing. Is the Bible true? And we believe it is, or we wouldn't be here. I remember counseling for baptism. The minister asked me that question. Why do you believe the Bible's true? And I just said, it's too perfect a book. The way it fits together, the way it's written, over so much time, it could not be a human creation. And he said, I agree with that. And I thought you might say prophecy. And I would support that view, too, that prophecy is God's way of showing that his word is true. There is so much that's happened. We see in Daniel, we know, and I'm not talking about prophecy today, but the incredible prophecy there of succeeding world-ruling governments, starting with the Babylonian, and then the Persian or the Medo-Persian, and the Greeks, and dividing among four governors, and the Roman with seven resurrections, and we look at history, and it happened. And it's still happening. It's ongoing, and people say, you know, the book of Daniel was written later than the Bible would indicate it is, and the genealogies would indicate it is, because it couldn't have been any other way. Of course, it could if you believe in God. This succession of Roman empires is still occurring, and I remember it was about 1982. I remember that because I had just started working at North Carolina State University, and I was attending church in Raleigh, North Carolina, and this is a time while Germany was still divided into the East, which was communist, Soviet-supported, East Germany, the West, which was a democracy. And you remember the Berlin Wall if you're a bit older, as old as I. And so this is 1982 I'm talking about, and Germany was in this state. And 5 years later, 1987, Ronald Reagan went to West Germany and challenged the Soviet leader Gorbachev to tear down this wall. And so that's the condition. 1982 was 32 years ago now. And I remember a minister saying at that time in a sermon that, you know, it doesn't look like it, but Germany will unite, as would Europe around Germany. And then he said, probably to the point of even having a common monetary unit. And I thought, wow, that's exciting. So I was baptized in 1981. This was shortly after that, and I did what many of us do. I went to work, and I wanted to talk about it. And I talked about it with someone there who was a religious person that, you know, prophecy indicates this is going to happen. And she, looking at the world as it was, divided Germany, ununited Europe, common monetary unit, said, that's not going to happen. How did this guy know? It was a remarkable call, wasn't it? Or else Bible prophecy is reliable. We do have the Euro now. We have had for some time. We do have the European Union. And we see these things coming together. So I ask, is the Bible true? Beyond fulfilled prophecy, what evidence do we have? And today I'd like to consider the Bible and archaeology. I was reading, and Mr. Reynolds mentioned that again in his message, the information we can find, what we can learn, the Bible and archaeology. So the first slide shows our booklet, one of the booklets we put together, and I was reading that, and that's where this came from. Do archaeological finds support or contradict the Bible? And the title I have today is the same as on this slide, The Bible and Archaeology. So I hope it's entertaining and informative, maybe kind of fun. The UCG website offers two of these compiled documents of good news articles on archaeological support for the biblical record. This first one says 1 through 12 on the cover because it's 12 articles from Good News that were compiled, and the second one will say 13 to 24 being another 12. So that's where I brought this message from, the first one that's shown there. And this one opens with one powerful example of physical evidence building the faith of a person that came in the life of an Englishman named William Ramsay. And the next slide shows Mr. Ramsay. He lived from 1851 to 1939. Ramsay was born into a wealthy family. He was raised as a non-believer by atheist parents. This is kind of back in the time of Darwin. And you know what? We're produced by evolution, and there is no God. And this was getting popular. And he was from a wealthy family. He was raised by atheist parents as a non-believer. Ramsay graduated from Oxford University with a doctoral degree and became a professor at University of Aberdeen. And he was determined to undermine the historical accuracy of the Bible as he had been taught by his parents. And he began using archaeology to do that as a tool to disprove the biblical account. Ramsay began his professional career by traveling to Palestine, to Greece, and Turkey, and focusing on the Book of Acts, which he fully expected to refute as nothing more than myth. The more he discovered, however, the more he came to see that even the tiniest of details in the books of Acts, names of places, titles of officials, administrative boundaries, even specific structures fit perfectly with archaeological finds that he was making and that others had made. And he became convinced over time, this is quoting his own words, the narrative shows marvelous truth with what I can find in archaeology. Contrary to all his earlier education and his teaching from his parents, he was forced to conclude that Luke, the author of Acts, was, his words again, a historian of the first rank, and that, quote, his statements, in fact, are trustworthy from the Bible. So Ramsay, in his career as an academic professor, became a very prolific writer of archaeological support of the Book of Acts, rather than refuting. The next slide shows a picture of Ramsay I found online. I was just looking for a picture, and this one came up. It also shows a 16-volume series. That's 16 volumes. He was quite a prolific writer, documenting his findings and offered by a company called Logos Bible Software. So this isn't part of our booklet, just something that came up with a web search. And the quote from Logos on this page is, William Mitchell Ramsay is perhaps one of the most fascinating biblical scholars from the turn of the 20th century, and his writings are full of knowledge and insight that can only come from one who has extensively experienced firsthand the archaeology and the people of Asia Minor. For decades, Ramsay immersed himself in the culture of what is now Greece and Turkey as he set out first to disprove the Bible as factual and then, to his amazement, to show how the New Testament has proved itself to be historically infallible based on his findings. The 16 volumes that make up the William Mitchell Ramsay collection provide a unique look at the life and studies of this intriguing archaeologist. So I'm sure this would be an interesting work to read. Ramsay shocked the academic world when in one of his books he announced that because of the incontrovertible evidence that he had discovered for the truthfulness of the Bible, he had become a Christian. And several of his works on New Testament history are considered classics. So I didn't mention any of the archaeology that he found, but this was an introductory part to the first booklet that we saw on the first slide. Regarding Ramsay's experience, we might turn to New Testament, Book of Luke. Look with me at Luke 19. And these are words of Christ here. And this is sometimes tied to archaeology and things that are found and being found. And this is a growing field. Archaeology was not that important 100 years ago. It's in fairly recent times that we're finding more and more, and some rather amazing things. Luke 19, verse 37, then as he, and this is Christ, as Christ was now drawing near the descent of the Mount of Olives, the whole multitude of the disciples began to rejoice and praise God with a loud voice for all the mighty works they had seen. And they had seen mighty works. So they were very excited about that and saying, blessed is the King who comes in the name of the Lord. There's a millennial aspect to this. Peace in heaven and glory on the highest. And some of the Pharisees called to him from the crowd, Teacher, rebuke your disciples. But he answered and said to them, I tell you that if these should keep silent, the stones would immediately cry out. And so this is a large part of the basis for archaeology. And we find that the stones do cry out in support of the accuracy of the Bible as Ramsey found. Our booklet opens with that New Testament example, and then the first one moves to the Old Testament, which is where I'll be spending time today. In the next slide, I provide a timeline just for archaeology. As we know, God and the Father have always existed, and Mr. Holliday sent out a letter about 2 weeks ago where he was kind of pondering and musing over this time when God and Christ must have sat together and talked about creating more beings. And we don't know how long ago that was, but sometime in the past, the angelic realm was created. And then following that, the earth was created, the universe, and we know that because of the book of Job telling us that the angels shouted for joy when the earth was created. Then Lucifer, with a third of the angels, was placed on the earth, and this is Lucifer, a good guy, friend of God. Something went wrong later. Perhaps he didn't like the idea of preparing the planet for humans who might have greater potential than the angels. We don't know what happened, but Lucifer did rebel. The earth became tohu and bohu, confusion, disarray. God had to recreate the surface of the earth, and then he created humans, Adam and Eve, and they fell. So with humans, we have the beginning of archaeological information. Look in Genesis 3 about this time that we've just worked our way up to very quickly through the history. Genesis 3 and verse 4. So very familiar to us. Then the serpent said to the woman, "You will not surely die." But in fact, she did, didn't she? And in verse 6, so the woman saw the tree was good for food and that it was pleasant to the eyes and a tree desirable to make one wise. The tree. She took of the fruit and ate. She also gave to her husband with her, and he ate. Verse 22, consequences. Therefore the Lord... Then the Lord God said, "Behold, the man has become like one of us, to know good and evil. And now, lest he put out his hand, take also the tree of life and live forever." See, Adam was not converted yet. We can't give him eternal life. We don't need any more Satans around. He may not have become one. He might have, taking of the tree of life at this point. Therefore, so this doesn't happen, the Lord sent him out of the Garden of Eden to till the ground from which he was taken. So he drove out the man, and he placed cherubim at the east of the Garden of Eden, and a flaming sword was turned every way to guard the way of the tree of life so that they could not return to that garden. Here we have recorded one of the earliest biblical events that has to do with humans, Adam and Eve being driven out of the garden. Think about what they would tell their children, or what you might if it was you. Boy, we messed up. We had it made. We listened to Satan. We ended up getting ourselves kicked out of paradise. So would this be a story that would be remembered? Would this be passed down as your parents and your grandparents talked about what was had, what was lost? Would it be passed down to coming generations of children? Do we find ancient renditions of a man, a woman, a tree, a serpent carved into stone or fired into clay? Whereas papyrus and parchment documents don't preserve well, ancient seals made of fired clay have survived and been found, some quite recently. These seals were used to certify documents and agreements, worn as amulets. I wasn't sure exactly what an amulet was. I kind of knew, but I looked it up on the free online dictionary. It says it's an ornament or small piece of jewelry, worn as a charm and thought to give protection against injury, evil, or disease. So we find these things. Is the Adam and Eve story only a myth? Many critics believed, as in the book of Daniel, the Bible, and therefore Genesis, and therefore the Adam and Eve story, to be much newer than genealogy suggests. Archaeological finds have shown this not to be the case. And the next slide shows a carved stone tablet or seal. And this one was dated to 5,000 years old. So this is before the flood, and found in an ancient site in Sumer, S-U-M-E-R, from where we derive the word Sumerian. A seal that has come to be known as the Temptation Seal, and this is now in the British Museum, kind of like our Smithsonian. This 5,000-year-old carving shows a man and a woman viewing a tree, and behind the woman is a serpent. the man and the woman are both reaching for the fruit of the tree. You know, something we might expect to see if a story about being tossed out of the Garden of Eden was true. And in the memories of people, of children, and next generations, here we have a rendition of something very like found in the book of Genesis. Other seals of this sort have been found. The oldest of seals like this one is a 3500 BC Sumerian seal, and it's on the next slide. So 3500 BC would make it about 5500 years old, again, well before the flood. Okay, and that's probably a little hard to see, but what appears on this, or what it looks to show, is a naked man and a woman both bent over as if oppressed or downcast, while behind them and partly broken on this one is a serpent. This one has come to be known as the Adam and Eve seal, presently held in the University Museum in Philadelphia. Many critics again thought that the Adam and Eve story originated in the Bible. But the Bible was written much later than these things were carved. When archaeology began uncovering them, not in biblical Israel, but in sites of the most ancient civilizations, what appear to be renderings of a man, a woman, a snake, and other aspects of the Genesis story, it was realized that biblical genealogies placed the date of the Adam and Eve story long before to the time these seals were carved. We, of course, can speculate as to if findings like these are coincidence or ancient renderings of a story carried forward from the descendants of Adam and Eve, as we would expect from an event like this. These artifacts do suggest that humans knew the essentials of the temptation incident long before the biblical account was recorded by Moses in Genesis, and are evidence the timing of events described in the Garden of Eden are as old as the Bible indicates they are. So moving forward, the next slide goes back to the timeline, and we see we have humans created and they fell. And so we have things like this temptation seal that appear to reflect that. And then the flood. I've got the date here, 2348 BC. We'll find the flood variously dated around this time. This is not an uncommon date used. It comes from Usher, also used in the English Bible. I found there, this is about 4,362 years ago now. Is the Genesis account of a flood only a myth of the Bible, originating in the Bible, or did earlier cultures show, as would be expected, a knowledge of the flood passed down to them from their ancestors? So after the flood, we have human civilizations, and we know Babylon and the Tower of Babel shortly after that, and the confounding of languages, which would put a story of a flood into cultures everywhere, because these people didn't realize they weren't speaking the language that they had always spoken. They're just speaking a new language. They have the same memories, the same background. Do we find the stories of the flood in many cultures and many languages? So before considering that, let's consider that beyond clay and stone carved with images, many ancient artifacts unearthed by archaeologists, large stones, monuments, old temple and pyramid walls had writings on them. And the next slide shows some of these writings, I believe. Okay, and actually I slipped this one in. It isn't the slide I originally had in, and I developed this talk about 2 weeks ago. And this one showed up, and I thought, you know, I'm going to pull that slide in. I have in my notes this past Tuesday, but really it's about 2 weeks ago. And the stone this man is holding was dated to 4,000 years old, or just past the flood. The British Museum has put this on display. And then quoting, a 4,000-year-old cuneiform tablet that recounts specific instructions for building a giant vessel to survive a coming flood and how it should house animals two by two. And so this is hard to see, but this is the writing on there, and it is cuneiform. The tablet, hailing from ancient Mesopotamia or modern-day Iraq, has been dubbed a prototype of Noah's Ark described in the Bible. So here we have a flood story. This is now called the Noah's Ark Stone. Understanding the biblical relevance of stones like this and cultures and people who were behind the writings made translating them critical. Not a trivial task at all. This professorial sort on the slide here holding the Noah's Ark stone said, "I recognize it immediately as a flood story." So he can read, he can translate cuneiform. He said it took me about 2.5 days to translate this stone, but I recognized it immediately as the flood story. And then he said, clearly, there was a huge deluge or flood in the Mesopotamia area long ago. He doesn't sound like a Bible believer in the way he talks about this. It was probably a tsunami, and I suppose that must have come from the Mediterranean Sea, that was heavily imprinted into the minds of the people. And so we find these ancient stones that he recognized here as the flood story. But learning how to read Egyptian hieroglyphic language then was also critical for understanding a culture very relevant to the events of the Bible. And the next slide, I think, shows some of this hieroglyphics. You can imagine trying to read this hieroglyphic writings for a considerable time, indeed, were described as unreadable. They remain unreadable for humans. The deciphering of this ancient language, and hieroglyphics is a word meaning priestly or sacred writings, is attributed to a young scientist in the early 1800s, and he's pictured there, Jean-Francois Champollion. So how did he do it? How could someone do that, translate a language like that? Accurate translations were made possible largely by the 1799 discovery of a large black basalt rock by French soldiers in the town of Rosetta. And the next slide shows this rock, now called the Rosetta Stone. And I don't know if we can see. You can kind of see there's a pattern here of writing, another one here of writing, and another one here of writing. So it was realized the stone bore a trilingual inscription, or three languages. One was Old Egyptian hieroglyphic. One was Demotic, or a later simplified form of Egyptian hieroglyphics. And the key here, and the value of finding this stone, is the third language was Ancient Greek. And Champollion said, "I wonder if all three say the same thing." And it turned out they do. These are three different languages all describing the same thing. Using the Greek on this stone, which Champollion could read, in 1822 he was finally able to decipher, to read, the ancient hieroglyphics and bring the culture of the pharaohs to light. Next slide shows a close-up of the bottom of this stone. This stone is about two-thirds as tall as a person, so it's a good-sized stone. And I think that's Greek there, but I don't read Greek, so some of you might know better than me. So the hieroglyphics was very important, but not the only language key to supporting biblical events like this Noah's Ark stone that we can now do. Other stone and hardened clay tablets were also being found that contained scratches resembling birds' feet, and the next slide shows one of those. And so this is similar to that Noah's Ark stone. This is the cuneiform language on there. Scientists initially thought that these were just decorations, but later started realizing, you know, this is part of a language. There is writing here. There is meaning in this. The marks look like they are made by wedge-like writing tools, and the Latin word for a wedge was a cune, C-U-N-E-I, which is where we get the name cuneiform. This was a writing used in the time of Darius, king of Persia, that we read about in the Bible. Darius is mentioned in Ezra 6 with the decree of Darius you may have heard about. Or if we look in Daniel, let's look in Daniel 6 just to read a little bit about Darius before looking at some of the things he left for us. In Daniel 6, and then move back to archaeology. Daniel 6 and verse 1, it pleased Darius to set over the kingdom 120 satraps, or governors, rulers, to be over the whole kingdom. And this again is a story I know very familiar. For over these three governors, of whom Daniel was one, that the satraps might give account to them, so that the king would suffer no loss. Then this Daniel distinguished himself above the governors and the satraps because of it. An excellent spirit was in him. And that excellent spirit is called the Holy Spirit. And the king gave thought to setting him over the whole realm. But the rest of the satraps didn't like that, so they tried to find fault in him and get Daniel removed. In verse 5, we see at the end, they couldn't find any charge against Daniel unless we can find it against him concerning the law of his God. something we all face now and then with the Sabbath and so forth. So these governors tried to attack Daniel that way. In verse 8, "Now, O king, establish your decree and sign the writing so that it cannot be changed according to the law of the Medes and Persians." The second great world ruling government coming out of the statue seen by Nebuchadnezzar in his dream and prophecy, which does not alter. Therefore, King Darius signed the written decree. And Darius was involved in the ultimate deciphering of the cuneiform writing. He liked to leave behind writings. He left behind quite a bit of his exploits. The next slide shows the Persian government rule in its maximum expanse and some carvings from that time. And this one on the left here is King Darius carved into a rock wall. And the next slide shows another view of Darius right here. This is far out, but that's the one we just saw a close-up of. And here are a number of captives of war being led before him. So he left many things like this. And credit for deciphering the cuneiform writing came from these that Darius left behind. Credit goes mostly to an agent of the British government stationed in Persia named Henry Rawlinson. So he was stationed in Persia, and he had an interest in these old writings. And Rawlinson used what is called the Rosetta Stone of cuneiform that he found, and it's a much bigger stone than the last one we saw, and it's actually what we're seeing here on this whole rock wall, this face here with the carving. This is a 1,700-foot-tall Persian cliff that was engraved to show, again, exploits of King Darius. Inscription of his exploits, like the Rosetta Stone, were provided here in three languages. And you can kind of see there's writing here on the stone wall. There's writing on the stone wall. And it's given, again, in three languages. I don't know why Darius did that. These were Persian, which Rawlinson could read, Elamite, and Babylonian, which we couldn't read, which was close to us. Rawlinson spent 2 years traveling to this site and climbing the cliff and hanging by ropes. Over the inscriptions, which he copied and studied, he brought back to his office and studied these. And ultimately, because he knew Persian, he was able to decipher Babylonian cuneiform and opening the understanding of the ancient Babylonian country culture to the world. So this is how that Noah's Ark stone I showed a little bit ago was read, and how the guy said, I recognize immediately this is a story of the flood in this stone. Next slide, I think, shows a little bit of a close-up, and we can see over the heads of these captives of war some of this writing that's in cuneiform, and a picture of Rawlinson here. So with that platform of opening ancient languages to archaeologists, you know, it made me think of the book of Daniel, too, where Daniel said, what does it mean? And God said, go your way. It's sealed up until the time of the end. And as we approach that time, as we come into it, humans for the first time were able to break these old languages and read things like these old flood accounts. With that platform, let's turn to one of the most questioned accounts of the Bible. It has been Genesis 6. You know, people use it as a joke now. When they talk about, you believe in this Bible that says this and that, it's kind of just a joke. Genesis 6, verses 13 to 14. And so Adam and Eve were kicked out of the Garden of Eden, and God said, I'd prefer that we didn't need to do it this way, but I will back off and let you do it your way. And they said humans became so decrepit, so violent, that it's a lesson learned. It's a tremendous lesson learned that we find in this chapter. And in verse 13, and God said to Noah, the end of all flesh has come before me. The lesson has been learned. For the earth is filled with violence through them. Behold, I will destroy them with the earth. Make yourself an ark of gopher wood with rooms in the ark and cover it inside and outside with pitch. Chapter 7, verse 11. In the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month, in the 17th day of the month, on that day, all the fountains of the great deep were broken up, and the windows of heaven were open. So this is with the flood. Verse 17, Now the flood was on the earth 40 days. The waters increased and lifted up the ark, and it rose high above the earth. So this is the ark described in the Noah's Ark stone we saw. And the waters prevailed and greatly increased on the earth, and the ark moved about on the surface of the waters. And the waters prevailed exceedingly on the earth, and all the high hills under the whole heaven were covered. Verse 23. So he, God, destroyed all living things on which were on the face of the earth, both man and cattle, creeping thing and bird on of the air. They are destroyed from the earth. Only Noah and those who were with him in the ark remained alive. So we have a story here about a man. Only Noah and those who were with him remained alive, and the waters prevailed on the earth 150 days. And in chapter 8, verse 6, so it came to pass at the end of the 40 days that Noah opened the windows of the ark which he had made, and he sent out a raven, which kept going to and fro until the waters had dried up from the ark. He sent out also from himself a dove to see if waters had receded from the face of the ground. So here's we have the flood of Noah's time. Around 100 years ago, again, as humans became enlightened by Charles Darwin and others, or William Ramsay, the first individual we were looking at whose parents raised him as an atheist, this event came to be considered one of the most fanciful of biblical myths. The book of Genesis, and therefore the flood story, were again felt to be much newer than the biblical account and the genealogy suggested. Has the past century and a half of archaeologic digging revealed accounts of the biblically described flood that come from the earliest civilizations, as might be expected if generations following Noah were told of the event by their parents and grandparents? So if you were on the ark, wouldn't you talk about it to your kids and their kids and describe, you wouldn't believe what the world was like that we left and how God saved us in this ark, and there was a flood that it's beyond imagination. Would this be passed down following Noah? One of the most astounding finds of this sort, and I wrote this before that Noah's Ark stone showed up, but of this sort, is called the Gilgamesh Epic. So an epic is a story, and this stone is sometimes described as the oldest written story on earth, dated to between 2750 and 2500 B.C., so just after the time of the flood, a few hundred years. And the next slide shows one of the tablets of this story, this epic. The epic is Babylonian, cuneiform, so we couldn't read it until recently in human history. It was found in the ruins of the city of Nineveh and describes the adventures of a historic king. It was written on 12 clay tablets in cuneiform and translated in 1872 by George Smith. Okay, he's on that slide of the British Museum again. Mr. Smith was surprised to find a Babylonian narrative of the flood account in these ancient tablets. And so this counters the idea that the Bible was really written much later than it seems to be, because we're finding the same story in stones at the time of the flood. So it's dating to not long after the Bible dates the flood. It has a story of the flood. I think I put some words on this slide. It describes how the God sent a flood to destroy the world. Like Noah, this individual was forewarned and built an ark to house and preserve all living things. After the flood, he sent out birds to look for dry land. So the story is just what we read in the Bible here. And this shows this story does predate the time when, or dates to the time when the Bible describes it as dating. Okay, if you're interested, you can find a translation of these 12 tablets on ancienttext.org. So they've all been translated there. The stone dated to not long after the flood, or after the Bible dates the flood, has the story of the flood. If the Bible account is fanciful, why is the same story found in this stone from a time not long after the flood? There's a remarkable concordance with this story, including the release of birds to look for dry land. Our published indicates regarding ideas that historians had before it came clear that the Bible is correctly dating events like the one we're finding on this stone. The Sumerians, Babylonians, and Assyrians of Mesopotamia might well be expected to cherish a similar tradition to that of Hebrews, since they all live so close together. They're close together about an antediluvian civilization or a post-flood civilization. But we've come to realize, remarkably, in other cultures we find the same story. A legend of Manu preserved among the Hindus, of Fahi among the Chinese, of Niu among the Hawaiians, all corners of the earth, of Tespi among the Mexican Indians, of Manabozhu among the Algonquins. All of these legends have all mankind being destroyed by a great flood as a result of divine displeasure at human sin, and include that a single man with his family or a very few friends survived the catastrophe by means of a ship or raft or a large canoe of some sort. And I'm quoting now from historian Archer in his book, page 209. So, to me, this is support of the confounding of the languages. And then we have the same story in all these languages. Coincidence? Or records of a real event passed on through many cultures after the confounding of the languages at the Tower of Babel? Our booklet mentions a professor, Aaron Smith, who spent his lifetime, his professional lifetime, telling all the flood stories he could find. Do these show up in multiple cultures? Are they kind of around the world, many languages? This was an active fellow. The stories about a great deluge he found totaled over 80,000 in 72 languages. To me, it's similarly compelling that the Babylonians worshipped a mother god and her child. I did a talk about Easter and mother-child worship, and I just pulled two slides out of that, and the next slide shows one of these. This is Semiramis and Tammuz worshipped by the Babylonians. Do we find these two figures in other languages, which we would expect after confounding of the language? And here we see many statues showing a mother and child. The next slide I just kind of listed. Semiramis and Tammuz in Babylon, Xingmu, Holy Mother and Child in China, Herthra and Child in Germany, and so forth. So we find these figures here again in many cultures, and I think very good evidence in support of Genesis 11:7, that's the confounding of the languages. So I've mentioned the Tower of Babel while reviewing these archaeological finds. Is there evidence such a tower may have existed? I mean, shouldn't there be? That was a big structure that was being built. Next slide shows some artist renditions of the Tower of Babel. Excavations in Iraq in the early 1900s revealed an enormous tower existed in Babylon at one time. So the foundation of a very big tower was found. It was referred to by the Sumerians as the Itemenaki. Itemenaki, which means a temple of the foundation of heaven and earth, is what they called this thing. It's unclear exactly when Itemenaki was first built, but archaeologist Andrew George provides evidence that it already existed in the second millennium BC, or shortly after the time of the flood, and stated in one of his historic reviews, there is no reason to doubt that this ziggurat, which means a tower, was the Itemenaki. And what he's saying was the Tower of Nimrod, was the Tower of Babel. Next slide shows that individual, I believe, Andrew George. So he's a professor of Babylonian culture, University of London. He says the evidence is there, that this is what it appears to be, the base of the ancient Tower of Babel. His view was in part based on findings and his review of the archaeologist Robert Coldaway, another professor who lived from 1855 to 1925 and spent his professional life excavating what was called at that time the famous ruined mound of Babil, B-A-B-I-L. Coldaway found that the bricklaying technique described in the Bible at the building of the Tower of Babel corresponds with the large base of whatever structure was originally there that he was excavating. Look in Genesis 11. So we're nearby here. Genesis 11 in verse 3. So here we have them building the Tower of Babel. Then they said to one another, come, let us make bricks and bake them thoroughly. So we see what the structure was made of, baked bricks. They had brick for stone, and they had asphalt for mortar. Then they said to them, and they said, "Come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower, a city and a tower, whose top is in the heavens, and let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be scattered abroad over the face of the whole earth." So as the investigations confirmed by Coldaway, the base of whatever structure was there that he had found contained asphalt or bricks that were used for construction, especially in the foundation. The foundations and stonework were made waterproof and damp-proof with asphalt, which is basically tar. I looked this up in the Companion Bible explanatory notes, and they say of this asphalt that it is bitumen, and so tenacious to this day that detachment is almost impossible. And this is what Coldaway found there. So I looked up again, well, what's bitumen? Then another word, Free Online Dictionary defines this as a black viscous mixture of hydrocarbons, tar, in other words, obtained naturally as a residue from petroleum distillation, is used for road surfacing and roofing for waterproofing. So it's a lot of work to make your bricks, but it's even more work to collect tar and coat them all the way around for a tower you're putting on dry land. So it's a bit of a curious thing. Why the big interest in waterproofing a tower, especially its foundation? And the next slide shows the time this tower was built was not too long after this time here, where we have pictured people outside of Noah's Ark as the waters were coming up. So the base of the tower found by Coldaway, reviewed by Andrew George with tarred bricks as described in the Bible, is 295 feet on a side, suggesting a height of 300 feet, which is a 20-story building. I was looking out my office window yesterday, and the building across the street is 5 stories tall. And I kind of imagined 4 of those on top. That's really tall, especially for back then, a 20-story building, 300 feet tall, based on the platform that they found here. Research has revealed that the original tower was destroyed, so that there's no tower there now. And on the same site, a similar tower was later built at the time of Nebuchadnezzar. How do we know this to be the case? Nebuchadnezzar living 2,500 years ago, with only 4 rock carvings having ever been found, giving us some idea of his appearance. So the Babylonian city was destroyed in 689 BC by Sennacherib, an Assyrian ruler, who claims to have destroyed the Itamenaki. So he said, "I took down the Tower of Babel." This ruler in 689 BC, the city was restored by Nabopolassar and his son Nebuchadnezzar. It took 88 years to rebuild the city. Its central feature was the Temple of Marduk, with which the Itamenaki, the ziggurat, the tower was associated. The ziggurat was rebuilt by Nebuchadnezzar. The 7 stories of the ziggurat reached a height of 91 meters, which again is about 300 feet, according to a tablet from York that was found. The next slide shows this tablet. And this tablet has been in a man's private collection, an individual who just liked collecting these things and only recently interpreted it. This tower built by Nebuchadnezzar then contained a temple or shrine at the top. It's a little hard to see here, but here's Nebuchadnezzar. Here's the tower he built. And right here, can you see? This is Nebuchadnezzar. That's this. And the tower's right there, and I think we can't see that. And then this stone is inscribed with Nebuchadnezzar's words on the stone, and it was found among the ruins of the tower. It's now known as the Tower of Babel Steel, a steel meaning an upright stone or slab, kind of like a tombstone. Inscribed or sculpture's surface uses a monument or commemorative tablet. And on this stone was cuneiform, which now we can read. And it says, and these are Nebuchadnezzar's words on the stone with his inscription, "The tower, the eternal house, which I founded and built, I have completed its magnificence with silver, gold, and other metals, stone, enameled bricks, fir, and pine, the first." So now he's referring to another tower that was there, which is the house of the earth's base, the most ancient monument in Babylon. This was just translated a couple years ago, so again, very recent. His words saying, "The first tower, the most ancient monument of Babylon, I built and finished it. and I have exalted his head with bricks covered with copper. We say that the other, and he's referring again to what used to be there, that is this edifice, the house of seven lights of the earth, the most ancient monument of Borsippa. And this word derives from Beer's Nimrod, the Tower of Nimrod. So he's saying the first, the Tower of Nimrod, a former king built it, but he did not complete its head. Since a remote time, people have abandoned it. Now we're in Genesis 11. Look at verse 7. Genesis 11, verse 7. So we found words of Nebuchadnezzar that he found the foundation of the tower, which he called the Tower of Nimrod, and he rebuilt what this ancient king had built. Genesis 11, verse 7. Come, let us go down there and confuse their language that they may not understand one another's speech. So the Lord scattered them abroad from there over the face of the earth, and they ceased building the city. Therefore its name is called Babel, because the Lord confused the language of all the earth. And from there the Lord scattered them abroad over the face of the earth. So this Tower of Babel steel with an inscription from Nebuchadnezzar said a former king built it, but he didn't complete it. Since a remote time, the people abandoned it without order, expressing their words. It almost sounds like the confusion of the words. Merodach, the great god, excited my mind to rebuild this building. I did not change the site, nor did I take away from the foundation. I set my hand to finish it and to exalt its head as it had been done in ancient days, so I exalted its summit. And what I'm quoting now is in the new McClintock and Strong Encyclopedia, what was just read there about this Tower of Babel steel. These are amazing finds. The Tower of Babel steel was found among the Shoyang collection, and that's the businessman I mentioned. And the December 30th, 2011 Daily Mail UK Science Tech article. So 2011, just not 2 years, just over 2 years old. A carving of the Tower of Babel has been found on a stone tablet dating back over 2,500 years. It comes from the newly published book, Cuneiform Royal Inscriptions and Related Texts in the Shoyang Collection. The collection is owned by Norwegian businessman Martin Shoyang, who has amassed over 13,000 ancient manuscripts and tablets. Still mostly untranslated, it makes you wonder what else might be in there. And he's allowing people who can read these to now come in and interpret them. Final demolition of the tower that Nebuchadnezzar built was by Alexander the Great in 323 BC, who intended to rebuild it, but died before being able to do so. So there is no tower there today, just this foundation that Andrew Coldaway described with the tarred, waterproofed bricks. Is the Bible true? Are its descriptions reliable? Our booklets, The Bible and Archaeology, So Much Evidence, support the historic accuracy of the Bible. I've just moved through the first few in order. There's a lot in these. The first booklet continues by evaluating the fall of Jericho. And this is a story we all know with the walls down. They talk about a starvation siege that it's normal for a walled city like this, or where they can protect it well and it's difficult to get in. So what they do is they just stay outside other armies and wait until their food runs out and they have to come out. But the article says there was no starvation siege there because the walls are full of large clay vessels that have grain in them. And they said this is unusual because when the victors overtake the city, which we can see happen, and threw the walls down, they would take the most valuable thing out of the city, the food. And yet the food was still there. And what does God say about Jericho? Don't go in, don't take anything. So it lines up very well. Fall Jericho was the next story in the booklets. Brick making in Egypt using strong clay. The biblical description and what's been found comparing that. Joshua's altar. Water shaft used by David when entering Jerusalem. The pool at Gibeon. And many more. As William Ramsey said, the first fellow I talked about who studied Acts, the archaeologist who studied Acts to disprove it, Luke, the author of Acts, was a historian of first rank, and his statements of fact are trustworthy. Of course, God is the true author of the Bible. Is the Bible true? Can we trust God's word? Let's close with Psalm 119. I was just staying in the Old Testament since I've been there. There's many very similar verses elsewhere and in the New Testament, but Psalm 119 and verse 160, first half of that verse, the entirety of your word is truth. And I saw just this last, just this last week, something about camels that were dated to after the time of Abraham, but their bones staying them looked like they had never borne weight, so the patriarchs obviously didn't ride camels, and we're going to see more of that. With Jericho, there was considerable information about it being misdated for the time those walls came down to compare to Joshua, but recent study has shown, you know, actually it's dated to within just a few years of when the Bible says it was. So we'll see these things. So this verse says, the entirety of your word is truth. Can we trust God? Can we trust his word? The answer, of course, yes, God is trustworthy. His word is true. We can fully put our trust in what he has revealed to us.